What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
This episode is brought to you by ServiceNow, the AI platform for business transformation. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. Enter ServiceNow. It puts AI to work for people, for employees, for developers, and even your customers, removing frustration and supercharging productivity. On our intelligent platform, AI isn't just a promise. It's happening today. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. To learn more, visit servicenow.com/AI for people.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. A Space Odyssey drew waves into movie theaters with revolutionary special effects and mind-bending drama. My guest today says they don't make them like that anymore. He should know. Douglas Trumbull gave his visual effects wizardry to 2001, Silent Running, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Star Trek, Blade Runner, The Tree of Life, and much more. Movie theaters today have to go big and ambitious or die, he says. The 3D we've seen is not enough. This hour on Point, saving the movies with effects visionary Douglas Trumbull. It was a long time ago that Douglas Trumbull got right in the middle of some of the most ambitious films ever made. Here from the 1968 movie 2001 A Space Odyssey, the sentient computer HAL, voiced by Douglas Rain, goes rogue and tries to kill off the human crew of the spaceship Discovery 1, including astronaut Dave Bowman, played here by Keir Dullea.
Open the pod bay doors, HAL.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
That was then. Douglas Trumbull joins me now from Amherst, Massachusetts, legendary filmmaker and visual effects pioneer. He's behind the effects of Stanley Kubrick's 2001, Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He's there in Star Trek, the motion picture, Blade Runner, Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life. He directed Silent Running and Brainstorm. Last month, he was awarded a Gordon E. Sawyer Special Achievement Oscar by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, plus the Georges Méliès Lifetime Achievement Award from the Visual Effects Society. He is a giant in the field. Douglas Trumbull, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
We were looking forward to having you last week, and Mother Nature rolled out some of her special effects and made that
a little tricky. We had a little too much ice to get even out of our own driveway.
No, not at all. We're very happy to have you with us today. I mean, you're not that old, Doug Trumbull. You must have been a kid when you worked on 2001 A Space Odyssey back in 1967, 68. How did you find yourself? How did you get into the middle of Stanley Kubrick's big, big legendary film?
Well, I was a young artist, and I was very interested in science fiction, and so my little portfolio, which was almost photorealistic, was a lot of paintings of alien planets and spaceships and things like that, because that's what I was interested in mm-hmm. as an artist. Mm-hmm. And that landed me a job working for a small company in Hollywood called Graphic Films, and Graphic was making films for NASA and the Air Force and other agencies of the government about the space program. Mm-hmm. And then they got a job to do a film for the New York World's Fair that opened in 1964, and it was called To the Moon and Beyond. And it was a film that depicted space and infinity and the Big Bang and everything in between in about 15 minutes, projected onto this giant dome-shaped screen in 70 millimeters Cinerama 360 film process. Mm. And so I did all the artwork for this film, and that was seen by Stanley Kubrick and Arthur Clarke, who were in New York at the time.
Okay.
And it was, I think, part of their decision-making process to validate that you could, in fact, make a science fiction movie of the kind of epic nature that they envisioned. And it wouldn't be, you know, a sci-fi B-movie, cornball movie. It would mm-hmm. be a truly intelligent and breathtaking movie.
Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick had a pretty cosmic vision for what they wanted to convey in 2001 A Space Odyssey. And some of the most really cosmic scenes You were the visual effects guy behind them. I mean, the Stargate scene. We're going to have listeners who know this so well and others who are so young they possibly may never have seen it. Would you describe what that looked like on the big screen and how you created it?
Well, first of all, you have to imagine that in the days that 2001 was made and shown, it was in the era of what was called Cinerama. And Cinerama was a giant screen, 70-millimeter process where the screens were 90 feet wide, deeply curved, stereo sound, and it was a spectacular form of film production and exhibition. And it allowed Kubrick to consider the possibility that a movie could actually be more of a first-person experience and kind of take the audience on this adventure rather than having to use standard cinematic conventions of two shots and close-ups and the normal that we see in movies every day. He was trying to make an experience that was a first-person experience rather than a third-person experience.
And by the time he got to the Stargate scene, trying to convey literally a cosmic experience there.
Yeah, and it was a very interesting little bit about that because I was tasked with trying to figure out how to make it work, which was a very exciting and fun bit of cinematic illusion because we kind of had to take the camera apart and turn the camera inside out in a way. The camera still had a lens on it, but the shutter of the image that would normally close and open between frames was actually 15 feet away from the camera on a big sheet of glass. And the camera could move to and fro from an inch from the glass to 15 feet away from the glass and change focus. And it created what you would call a streak exposure or a controlled blur. And so there was artwork moving behind this little slit, and when you move the camera during a one-minute-long time exposure, this slit would become a plane of light rather than a slit, and behind the slit was moving artwork that we drew and painted and pasted up with plastic and gels and lit it from behind. And so it became an exposure of this kind of infinite plane of colored abstract textures and shapes. And that became the Stargate effect.
Can you remember what Kubrick told you? What were your marching orders? What did he say he wanted to see on the screen?
He didn't know. This was a very interesting kind of creative developmental thing. It was originally written by Arthur Clarke as a slot in one of Jupiter's moons. There was kind of a rectangular opening in this moon, like a pit.
Mm-hmm.
And when they got over it and looked down, they realized there was another universe on the other end of the slot, you know, at the other side of this little moon.
Right.
And no one could figure out how to do that. You know, were we going to build a big model? Were we going to put the camera through a weird slot? So everybody on the movie was trying different ways. And I came up with this idea that was based on some earlier work that we did in To the Moon and Beyond. Done by John Whitney, and it was the whole idea of keeping the camera shutter open while things moved under controlled motors and optics. And so I did a little Polaroid of that on the animation camera and showed Kubrick that I thought it would work, and that was when he approved. He says, Doug, you know, this looks like it'll be our solution. What do you need? And I said, well, I need to build this giant machine that's going to be, you know, 40 feet long and 30 feet wide and 10 feet high. And I need a bunch of motors and gears and pulleys and cameras and lights. And he said, fine, just do whatever you need to do.
It's amazing you were able to create that almost the face of the cosmos. I mean, practically this hallucinogenic, immersive experience in a place beyond most of our imaginations.
Yeah.
Really without a touch of computer-generated anything.
Yeah, there were no computers or anything. This was all done with, you know, motors and controllers and things that are no more complicated than a darkroom timer or a Maytag washing machine.
And now,
but I think one of the interesting things I wanted to say about is that in this immersive trip that you're going on, you know, because the movie did become dubbed the ultimate trip, Kubrick intended to shoot reverse shots of Keir DeLay in the pod, you know, looking out at this Stargate and over-the-shoulder shots from behind the pod of the pod going through the Stargate, things like that. That would be the normal way you would shoot any car chase or action scene in any movie. But he realized that when you included shots like that, you intrude upon the audience's ability to actually feel like they're on the trip. You know, it's distracting. And that was the beginning of my whole career in what I call immersive cinema. And that that Stargate sequence really got it started.
Has CGI, computer-generated graphics of all kinds, have they liberated visual effects people or trapped them?
No, well, it's a double-edged sword because computer technology has allowed us to do the most amazing things that were unthinkable a few years ago. So I'm all for it. But it does break down into several different zones right now because we're in this transition from celluloid, you know, sprocketed acetate film to all digital photography with digital cameras rather than film cameras, and digital post-production where we edit the movie on computers, and now digital projection where we project with digital projectors. And so it's allowing us to kind of rethink the whole movie industry now and say, well, what could we do now that we could never do before?
And you're saying you better rethink it because, I mean, last year saw the fewest tickets sold at movie theaters in many years as a kind of crisis in confidence in the film industry about how to get people into the cinema.
Well, it has to do with what do you define the film industry as? People love to be entertained. And so there's no shortfall in any interest in seeing a movie. Mm-hmm. It's just that particularly younger people who are very comfortable with their computers and their smartphones and their iPads and tablets and things are streaming and downloading their entertainment and seeing it in a very convenient mobile form where they can do it anytime they want.
And not necessarily in a theater at all. We're going to come back and talk with Douglas Trumbull, great visual effects pioneer, about how he envisions what would bring people back to the cinema. Behind us right now, Rejoice in the Sun from his film, Silent Running. Tom Ashbrook will be right back with Douglas Trumbull with On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with visual effects pioneer, visionary Douglas Trumbull about what Hollywood needs to do now to pull people back to the movies, back to the movie theaters. Behind us right here, John Williams' score from Close Encounters of the Third Kind. You remember the big mothership coming down? That mothership and much more in special effects in the history of cinema was Douglas Trumbull's. Here's a little more from Steven Spielberg's 1977 Close Encounters of the Third Kind ends with that massive alien mothership descending to Earth. Humans communicate with the aliens using colored lights and musical notes.
The only thing these crazies have in common are fog signals.
I hope somebody's taken all this down.
What are we saying to each other?
Seems they're trying to teach us a basic tonal vocabulary.
It's the first day of school, fellas.
It's the first day of school, fellas. Humans interacting there with aliens. And here from Douglas Trumbull's earlier 1972 film, Silent Running, where the American government launches huge ships into space containing a polluted Earth's last surviving forests and plant life.
On this first day of a new century, we humbly beg forgiveness and dedicate these last forests of our once beautiful nation in the hope that they will one day return and grace our foul earth.
From Silent Running, 1972. We've got a lot to talk about today. Douglas Trumbull's work and his vision of what might bring people back to the theaters. He joins us today from Amherst, Massachusetts. And Douglas Trumbull, lots of people with calls for you. Mitch in Raquette Lake, New York. Mitch, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Douglas Trumbull.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Mr. Trumbull, Ray Harryhausen as a child watched King Kong and 20 years later, he was doing Mighty Joe Young and Destination Moon. What were your early influences?
Well, I guess it goes back to early science fiction writers and feeling like I really wanted to be on an alien planet and experience what that would be like to encounter alien creatures or be in another world or whatever. So it was mostly reading science fiction material from, you know, Robert Heinlein and Arthur Clarke and many others.
Reading, but it kind of ran in your family. Here's Mark online says the special effects that really got him going started with The Wizard of Oz. He goes then to Forbidden Planet. Goes to Blade Runner, yours. But it is interesting in one of these Hollywood stories of descent. I think it was your father who worked on Wizard of Oz special effects.
Yes, he did. Even before I could conjure up a memory, I heard from him later on that he had worked on The Wizard of Oz and many other films, although he left the movie industry and went into the aerospace and aircraft industry, you know, when I was still only 2 or 3 years old. So I don't have any direct memory of that. But he was in there with a fishing rod and a piece of fishing line, you know, wagging the lion's tail and manipulating rubber trees grabbing apples and doing wire rigs for flying monkeys and things like that. It was a physical special effects job in the movie industry when he was very young.
There's a kind of range to the work you've done which goes all the way from those very crisp technological presentations of spaceships, Star Trek, and elsewhere, the really cosmic stuff like we saw in 2001, but also these very moody views of life on this Earth. Here's a little clip from Ridley Scott's 1982 Blade Runner. Harrison Ford plays Rick Deckard, a man hunting down genetically engineered robots called replicants in this bleak, dystopian future Los Angeles. That visual effect was Douglas Trumbull's. Let's listen.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate.
There from Blade Runner. Douglas Trumbull, what's the thread that runs through this very broad spectrum of kind of effects that you've presented over time? I mean, from that those sort of foggy dystopias to the very crisp, oh my goodness, mothership, high-tech stuff. Did you imagine that you would just do whatever the director asked for and be ready to go?
Well, no. I mean, every movie has presents its own problems, and the directors and writers come up with, you know, what their needs are, and my job is to figure out how to solve those and deliver something to them. So every movie is completely different. But I guess my skill is that I work as an artist and also as a technologist. You know, I'm very comfortable with technical things, and so my father being an engineer and my mother being a graphic artist kind of gave me the right source code to feel comfortable being able to bridge between art and technology. And movies are a very technology-driven art form. And so I'm very comfortable with it, and it just comes very naturally to me to solve these problems that come up in every movie.
Despite this incredible body of work that you've got, you also, like your father, I guess, left movies, or at least left Hollywood at a certain point out of sheer frustration. Why did you do that?
Well, there's some, I think, problems in the movie industry that have to do with the fact that all of the components of the movie industry are kind of separated from each other, in that directors and producers who really passionately want to make their movie are one group of people, and then there are the studios themselves, who are really primarily distribution companies who finance the production of the movie and then distribute it to theaters. And then the third component is the theaters themselves, which is a completely separate business. We call it the exhibition business. And there are huge chains like Cinemark and Regal and AMC who own hundreds or thousands of theaters. And they're not connected to each other. They actually compete amongst each other for their appropriate piece of the revenues or their piece of the pie or whatever. And so there's not a lot of strong technological linkage between them. And so I find that there's not only problems in the industry but great opportunities right now, because this new digital transformation that's going on, not only with the directors and producers and cinematographers, but at the studios in digital distribution. There are almost no prints of films on 35-millimeter sprocketed film being shipped much longer. As you know, Kodak just went bankrupt, and that's a sign of the times. And at the exhibition end, we have digital projectors. And so the movie gets downloaded to the theater digitally and electronically, and there's not really even a projectionist there anymore. But one of the problems that I've been really talking about a lot recently is that 3D has created such a buzz in the industry, you know, and I think it was partly and maybe largely enabled by the advent of Avatar, which came out just at the moment that 3D was getting hot, and they managed to convert enough theaters to 3D with digital projection, because you can't do 3D with film very well.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have this situation where you have the same projector that you would have used before, but you put a filter in front of the projector to get the 3D effect, and so that cuts the light in half. Then you put on glasses, which no one really likes very much, and they cut the light in half again. So you end up with an image that's only a quarter the brightness of what you would normally expect. And this is one of the things that I think is a very, very dramatically powerful, serious issue right now, where images are simply not bright enough, not powerful enough, and not big enough to compensate for the kind of convenience factor that people experience now, being able to watch a movie on their iPad or their computer or their home TV.
I have to say, for all the hype around 3D, by the time you get into the cinema and get the glasses on and everything else, it can end up feeling to an ordinary cinema goer like much ado about not too much.
Yeah. So, I talk with other directors who are like-minded. We're all kind of horrified with this problem. And I think in general, we all agree that in order to keep people coming back to movie theaters or even increase attendance at movie theaters, it's not just about making some blockbuster movie or having great special effects. It's that the quality of presentation has to be tremendously upgraded, improved, and made very, very powerful in order to for people to make the decision to actually go out, you know, and see a movie, which is very inconvenient and expensive, hiring a babysitter or getting in the car or parking or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the experience of seeing a movie has got to be utterly spectacular and unobtainable on your laptop.
Or a lot of people just may not go, and in recent years they haven't been going. Douglas Trumbull joins us, legendary filmmaker, special effects guru. Michael's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Michael, you're on the air with Douglas Trumbull.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Doug. I just wanted to say, first of all, thank you to you and your contemporaries like Ralph McQuarrie and Dennis Muren. And you're the guys that got me into the business. I worked on effects work for film and done video games for 15 years now.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So thank you. Thank you for that. I guess my question, you know, from another effects guy is, I go to the movies and see a bunch of effects with not much story, and to my mind, that's where I draw the line. And I say, you know, I'm not going to go see, you know, like for example, you look at the Star Wars prequel films as an example. They're great little animated movies with a lot of effects, but not much depth to them. Versus, say, the Chris Nolan Batman series that has so much depth of story with effects that really serve, or Amelie that had effects that are some of the best effects I've ever seen in film, because they're, you know, you can't tell that story without it.
Right.
What's your take on that side of things in terms of?
I don't think it's possible for any special effect to supplant a good story. It just doesn't work, and it's not a sustainable model. So, people try it, and we see it regularly with what I call effects-driven action blockbuster tentpole movies that the studios seem to be convinced is what they have to provide. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is that there's nothing fundamentally wrong with making a movie that's got a lot of special effects, because people do like the special effects. It's just that my feeling is that everything in a movie is a special effect, and the whole illusion of motion is a special effect. And some of the problems that we're seeing right now is that the old conventions of 24 frame per second and flat rectangular screens is just not cutting the mustard any longer. And people do crave experiences that go beyond the limitations of their everyday reality. And so the point I'm trying to make is that if that's what people want, and I believe we can deliver it with good stories and good effects and good performances and good writing, to make a balanced movie that has all of the best qualities in the correct balance, so not one thing is trying to take over from the other, but that the presentation of it is so spectacular that it's really more like going to Cirque du Soleil or going out to a live Broadway show than it is seeing a flat two-dimensional movie, which is almost entirely effects-driven or almost entirely story-driven. There's a whole range between those.
I want to dive into what that would be comprised of technically. Let me get one more call here for you, Douglas. Elsa in Spokane, Washington. Elsa, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a point that, you know, movie theaters are so expensive now. It's really an expensive form of entertainment, especially for people who don't have jobs and teenagers, and not to mention the more expensive 3D films and stuff.
Yeah, it can really add up in a hurry.
Yeah, it's just an expensive form of entertainment, so I think that's why people refer to Netflix and other forms of downloading movies.
Elsa, that's right in the center of a lot of people's minds when it comes to movies these days. Douglas Trumbull wants to make it worth it. I appreciate your call, Elsa, but Douglas, take us into your formula. Well, let us understand first what you're envisioning, and we'll talk then about price and cost and how that might work for Elsa and others who want to go out, you know, on a Saturday night. But what would you do?
Well, one of the things that's been revealed just recently is that the old standard of 24 frames a second is inadequate for 3D, and that's a very technical issue. It's just that 3D doesn't look very good when the image blurs or moves too fast.
Mm-hmm.
It really wrecks the 3D illusion. And
so you need a denser concentration of frames?
Higher frames. And Peter Jackson is presently shooting The Hobbit at 48 frames a second. And Jim Cameron is about to shoot Avatar 2 and 3 at either 48 or 60 frames a second.
How does that change the experience of what we see on the screen? What does it feel like?
It makes it more vivid. It makes it more lifelike. It's a very weird thing to try to describe on the radio, but when you increase the frame rate to something extremely high, and I'm presently experimenting with 120 frames a second.
Wow.
Which is very, very easy to do because the digital cameras and projectors do it effortlessly.
Okay.
But the result is an image on a screen that's like a window onto reality. This is a completely different type of movie-going experience, and it's not appropriate for all movies by any means. But if you're trying to take people on an adventure to another dimension or another world or another time, like Avatar or even like The Wizard of Oz, you can go into this kind of hyper-reality cinema and it would be just fine. But if you're telling a love story or a mystery or whatever, 24 frames a second and a flat two-dimensional screen is absolutely appropriate. You know, like 3D is not appropriate for every movie either. So there's a big range. It's not that I'm threatening to change everything or change the rules.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to add another option to filmmakers. And so we need to increase the frame rates, but we also need to increase the brightness tremendously.
Why?
Because at low brightness, which you're getting now with 3D because of all the filters that are needed to create the 3D effect, your eyes don't see color very well at low brightness, and so you're kind of straining to watch the movie. Now, if you increase the brightness to above normal standards, it gets much, much more vivid. You see color saturation, contrast, vividness, and a kind of feeling that you're actually there in the movie rather than looking at a two-dimensional movie.
All that, plus you're saying much bigger screens, if I read you right.
Exactly right. So I want to get back to those days that I got seduced into the movie business on 90-foot Cinerama screens have pretty much gone away. And the only large screens right now are IMAX, and they do charge a premium price for an IMAX projection of a movie. So it's bigger, but it's still stuck at 24 frames.
I have a feeling this is not coming down to the price point that Elsa in Spokane would like to see. I mean, you seem to be describing something that will be more like paying to go to see Cirque du Soleil, which is...
I think that there's probably some new price point that's going to emerge, and you'll decide for yourself whether you want to go out to a movie spectacle or stream something on Netflix, and that's a perfectly good and legitimate price based upon what kind of experience you want to have.
Of course, people are making that decision already, and their decisions taking them home to the laptop or the computer screen or their own home video. Douglas Trumbull, please stand by there. It's great to have you with us today. Such a body of work behind this man in visual effects. Star Trek, the motion picture theme behind us right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with visual effects pioneer, visionary, really, Douglas Trumbull, about what Hollywood needs to do now to pull people back to the movies, to the movie theaters. Behind us right here, theme from Blade Runner, just one of his incredible body of film work, special effects, 2001 A Space Odyssey, Close Encounters, Star Trek, The Tree of Life very recently. It was Douglas Trumbull behind those incredible special effects in Terrence Malick's film last year, The Tree of Life, the story of a Texas family in the 50s. It also has extended sequences that show the birth and death of Earth and the universe, the evolution of life. Malick turned to Trumbull for those sequences. Throughout the movie, a whispered voiceover muses on life's big questions.
The nuns taught us there are two ways through life, the way of nature and the way of grace. You have to choose which one you'll follow.
The way of nature, the way of grace, and some incredible scenes going on there, and not computer-generated. Douglas Trumbull joins us from Amherst, Massachusetts. David's calling us right now from Bedford, Massachusetts. David, hi. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
A huge fan of you. You're my favorite on WBUR, first-time caller. I know the topic, I guess the main topic is bringing people back into the movies, the theaters, but the reason that the conversation really sparked my interest is because it turns out Douglas Trumbull, your guest, is behind many of my favorite movies of all time. I'm a huge fan of movies, and Silent Running, I remember growing up just, you know, watching that over and over, and then Space Odyssey, Close Encounters, Blade Runner's probably my top three of all time, so I tend to give credit to the directors of these projects, and now I'm curious how involved the visual effects people like Douglas are involved in the actual creation and results of these movies.
The sort of creative process in these films that you love. Douglas, what do you say? David wants to know how much love to throw around the director, how much love to throw around you.
Well, I am a director, and I've directed a couple of feature films, but I purposefully chose to change the trajectory of my career for a number of reasons. But I'm back to directing now, and I feel that it's my task right now to try to pull together everything I know, not only just about special effects or just about story or directing, but also about these new emerging digital technologies that I think are going to enable a kind of a rebirth of the cinematic experience. And that's going to open up what I think is one of the most exciting areas for me, which is to try to develop a new, more immersive, participatory cinematic language. And I feel that that's my job because I don't hear anybody talking about it. People think that a movie is just a movie. You either have a writer, you have a director, you have a producer, you have actors, you have an editor, and you project it. That's that. I want to change the whole nature of the experience to where the audience is actually in the movie and participating in the movie in some way rather than just looking at the movie. And that's where I started with 2001. I became very disappointed when the 70-millimeter giant screen went away and we kind of multiplexed ourselves into small screens. And now I feel it's my job to get back on the track, so to speak, and show the industry how we can build a new kind of experiential cinematic process that takes you into the movie. And it'll be like having a real experience in your life, not like looking at a movie, like a voyeur over the shoulder of an actor, but actually being in the movie.
I want to look at the technology of that and what the effect of it would be. But what about to David's question about this relationship between director and special effects? Now, you've done both. You've been on both sides of that. You've maybe done both for Silent Running, maybe both yourself. But
one of the aspects of that is that the directors that I've worked for know that I'm a director, and they actually turn over to me sequences of their films that they know I'm the guy that should be actually directing that sequence. I don't just do the special effects.
Right.
I actually design, conceive, and execute whole sequences of movies.
Do directors adapt their vision to what you can make possible or just give you the envisioning role?
It's both, actually. Every director's different. Some of them are more able to express themselves visually like Ridley Scott. I mean, you have wonderful meetings, really, because he's a wonderful artist.
Mm-hmm.
And so he'll sit there and start drawing on napkins or tablecloths with you and say, well, I want it to look like this or I want it to look mm-hmm. like that. And he's very astute about camera technology and lighting and things like that. So that's one conversation. With Steven Spielberg, it's much more about story and what he wants to see.
Mm-hmm.
But these directors have often said, well, what do I want to do? And I often say, well, you know, here's this big scene in Star Trek or something. I think we should take 5 minutes and just have a tour of the Enterprise and stop the story for a minute and just have this awesome experience.
Yeah.
And so I've had opportunities to do that with Star Trek. When the mothership arrives in Close Encounters, you know, Steven just kind of let me go with it.
Wow.
And,
wow.
You know, so you'll see these moments in these films where there's 2 minutes or 5 minutes, or in 2001, there's 15 minutes where there's just a big experience, an awesome, mind-blowing, altered state kind of experience that is what I like to do. And I think that audiences really enjoy that kind of thing.
Oh,
so
my
I'm
gosh,
kind of
yeah.
exploring, well, how can we do something that's totally different from the everyday storytelling processes that we see on television and in movies all the time. I mean, we're saturated with media. So it's easy to tell a story, okay? It can be a mystery. It can be a love story. It can be a musical, whatever. I'm trying to go into some new territory of experiential worlds and dimensions and things that I think people really crave and are very satisfied when they see it in the form I'd like to have them see it.
Give us a great story and then a great experience, and we're there. Matthew in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Matthew, thanks for calling. You're on with Douglas Trumbull.
Hi, Tom. What a pleasure to have Mr. Trumbull on. I have a quick question and a quick point.
Mm-hmm.
One is Close Encounters of the Third Kind, one of the greatest, one of my top 10 films of all time, and was very meaningful to me. Because my father had a close encounter with a UFO one time, and as soon as I saw Close Encounters, I dragged my father to see it to compare to his actual UFO experience.
Okay.
And I was wondering what Mr. Trumbull thought of the sort of the expanded version that was eventually released that had a different ending, which I thought was really superfluous. But my second point is about limitations in making art. It seems to me that some great works of art, including film art, often result because certain limitations were placed on the filmmaker. For instance, Spielberg's Jaws, where he was sort of forced mm-hmm. to not show the shark.
Mm-hmm.
And I think by removing all these limitations with CGI and so forth, it's sort of, I think we run the risk of the quality of films actually declining because of the emphasis on technology rather than
right.
storytelling. So,
Matthew, let us pick those up, both of them, and I thank you for them. Close Encounters, recut and expanded, what did you think, Douglas? And then the limitations questions, fascinating.
That's a really good question. It's one of my favorite questions, actually,
mm-hmm.
because I have made a very close friendship with Jacques Vallée. Now, Jacques is the French UFO researcher that is depicted by François Truffaut in Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not find out until many years after working on Close Encounters and making that movie that Jacques was a real person and that, in fact, Steven had read Jacques' books. And from Jacques' books, which are accounts of supposedly real events that people had, whether they got abducted mm-hmm. or saw a UFO or a first encounter, a second encounter, third encounter, whatever,
mm-hmm.
that was all very real. And so I started looking at Close Encounters with a completely new light, and I'm saying, well, this isn't entirely fictional. I mean, this is a fictional depiction of real events. It's a true story, or much of it is a true
story.
Did
that belief or conclusion on your part help you to bring your passion to what you presented on the screen?
Oh, yeah. But we even thought that we could confuse people by making a fake UFO sighting and giving it to CBS News. But you know, that was probably a really bad idea.
That's what you call a special effect.
But
what about limitations?
David
says, our caller says, you know, get too much CGI and you sort of lose, I don't know what, the tension that comes with limitations.
Well, there's a problem with computer graphics in that it's a mathematically based art form. And so we use all kinds of very complicated algorithms that are mathematical formulas to create a certain particle system or a texture or a map or a lighting or whatever. And it does have a certain synthetic quality to it if it's not really done perfectly well.
It can look kind of muddy.
Yeah, and so I'm very I still use miniatures. I love miniatures. I think they can still look photorealistic, and you still see things in 2001 or Close Encounters or Blade Runner or whatever that were miniatures that I would still, if someone asked me to do that today, I would still do it the same way. However, I would use computers to do the compositing and the alignment and mm-hmm. the matching of motion and all mm-hmm. that, those other aspects of it, because computers are fantastic and the tools are great today. We can do absolutely anything, but if we want the illusion to be so compellingly real, it has to have a component of real things to it. I call it organic effects, mm-hmm. the unexpected, the mm-hmm. unanticipated. And that's what
Which
we were doing.
You used in The Tree of Life.
Yeah. Terry Malick specifically said, you know, I have this problem with even the best supercomputers in the world at Carnegie Mellon or whatever, if they try to depict the growth of a galaxy or an intersecting star system or something, it just kind of looks synthetic.
And what I did said, you use?
We used a lot of liquids and dyes and paints in water and turbulence
swirling.
And air
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
ultra-high-speed photography of about 1,000 frames a second.
Wow.
And then we used computers to assemble those organic components into scenes that made sense.
But there's still an organic seed, nut at the heart of it. Mark, in,
exactly.
Mark in Nashville, Tennessee, you're on the air with Douglas Trumbull, Mark.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Doug, I was living in the Research Triangle area in North Carolina in the early 80s when Brainstorm came out, and I had a really keen interest in the show scan technology that you were working on, and was really disappointed when it sort of faded away. And from the last couple of questions, it sounds like you've never given up on that, and I'm hoping that I can look forward to a revival of that experience.
Brainstorm, well, which you of course directed, and as I understand it, you've got a big barn out in Western Massachusetts where you're still experimenting with this. What have you got coming for us, Douglas?
Well, part of that question is really good, because I was developing this technology called ShowScan way back in the it began in the mid 70s, and the idea was that you could photograph and project movies at 60 frames a second in 70 millimeter and project it very brightly onto very large screens. Mm-hmm. And everyone reported that the illusion of realism was profound and that it was like looking through a window onto reality.
Mm-hmm.
So I was working at Paramount and they said, okay, Doug, make a movie. So I started developing this movie called Brainstorm, which was about an experience that the performers are having, but the audience is actually going to be able to enter into their experience, and it was designed and written for ShowScan.
Mm.
The problem at the time was that I couldn't convince the industry to change all the projectors in all the theaters or all the cameras on all the stages or anything, and it was a kind of a catch-22. So it was a huge crippling disability for me, a disappointment that I couldn't make Brainstorm in ShowScan.
Mm-hmm.
Now the table has completely turned, because we have digital cameras and digital projectors that can effortlessly go at any frame rate you want. There's really no serious attendant problematic additional cost or additional technological thing.
But you've got small screen multiplexes, which you've said might as well go away.
Well, I think so. I think they're being supplanted. I mean, I'm not trying to denigrate the exhibition industry, but if people find it more convenient to watch the exact same thing on their laptop or on their computer at home or on their TV at home or on their smartphone, whatever, I think that we have to really improve what the theater going experience is going to be. So you have to do all these things, which is bigger screens and higher frame rates, better color, better brightness, and even better sound. There's all kinds of new dimensional sound systems that are emerging, which will give you experiences that you're not going to get at home.
You're working on this technology and on a new sci-fi film. Give us a sense, in your ideal world, what would the experience be like, the technology behind it and the setting in which we would witness it that would, in your view, bring people back into the theater?
Well, I'm working on a film that is a science fiction film. It occurs in deep space, maybe 100 to 200 years into the future, and it's touching on some of the material that we actually touched on in Close Encounters, as well as 2001, which is what's really going to happen if we do contact some alien civilization that's profoundly more intelligent than we are or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're seeing a lot of really stupid science fiction movies where aliens are always depicted as, you know, flesh-eating monsters.
Mm-hmm, right.
I think that's really boring and not mm-hmm. very intelligent. And mm-hmm. so I think there's an audience there for a much more intelligent take on alien contact. But what I'm trying to do is develop a story that tells that story from a unique point of view, takes place in the future, and will be an immersive experience on giant screens in this kind of technology I'm doing. And so the process we're doing here right now, which is very much fun is that on one end of the stage we have a set where we have a green screen and we can superimpose actors into computer-generated sets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I call virtual set photography. That makes the production very inexpensive and very fast. Then I replace the computer graphics background with miniatures that are much more photorealistic and much more believable. And then on the other end of the stage, I've got a giant hemispherical high-gain screen and the latest Barco and Christie projectors that they're loaning me to try out. Well, what's it going to be like if we actually shoot a scene in a unique, different way? We frame the shot, move the camera differently, project it at higher brightness in 3D.
Are you talking flat screen or IMAX curvature?
No, it's not even screen. It's like halfway between a flat screen and a planetarium.
Can you imagine this being rolled out across the country?
Yes, I can.
The economics work? We may, what,
yes.
In, what, 5 years, 10 years?
Less than that.
Less than that? How many screens in your dream?
I'd be happy with one because I just want to prove the point, but I think we could do hundreds or thousands.
We may indeed have a rebirth coming of movies if it comes to that. That sounds pretty incredible. Behind us here, music from the Tree of Life. Douglas Trumbull, we're grateful to you for a life's work and hope there's a lot more of it to come. Hope we're in one of these great big theaters seeing one of your films soon. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, and thanks for all the call-ins. Thank you, Tom.
Douglas Trumbull. We'll go out with Lacrimosa from the Tree of Life. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.